Case number 19-1779, Corey Thompson versus Gregory Skipper. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Fox for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is David Fox, and I represent the petitioner appellant, Mr. Corey Thompson. I have asked to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. The court has repeatedly addressed the level of evidence necessary to sustain a conviction when a defendant is found in the same car as a gun and the defendant cannot lawfully possess that gun. And the court has never upheld a conviction for gun possession on a record as thin as this record. Mr. Thompson was never seen with any gun by anyone at any time. The gun that police found was not in plain view, and it was not under Mr. Thompson's seat or within Mr. Thompson's reach. It was under a different seat, out of his reach and out of his sight. Mr. Thompson was not the owner of the vehicle in which the gun was found, although he was driving the vehicle. And Mr. Thompson was not the only one in the vehicle when he was arrested. There was a passenger in the vehicle who never testified at trial. That set of facts distinguishes every single case in which this court has ever upheld a conviction. And it is, in fact, a weaker set of facts than many cases in which this court has found insufficient evidence to support a conviction for gun possession. The Michigan Court of Appeals reached a contrary conclusion based solely on the fact that Mr. Thompson was also convicted of selling drugs on the night in question. But the fact is that the evidence of Mr. Thompson's drug sales simply did nothing to close the evidentiary gap between the gun in the car and Mr. Thompson. The gun was hidden in a separate part of the SUV from where the drugs are found. The drugs are found in plain view within his reach in the front of the car. The gun was found not in plain view, hidden in the back of the car. There was no evidence that Mr. Thompson had the gun at the time when when the evidence showed that he was selling drugs. That occurred in an apartment separately, and the informant did not testify that he had the gun then. So the fact is, under the test that this court has adopted in these cases, the drug dealing evidence that the Michigan Court of Appeals relied on simply does nothing to close the evidentiary gap. So with the court's permission, I'll start with the question of deference under Wilson versus Sellers. And then after that, I'll turn to a more detailed discussion of both the Michigan Court of Appeals' reasoning and then the other evidence in the record that the Michigan Court of Appeals did not rely on. So to start with Wilson versus Sellers, in Wilson, which is a Supreme Court case from 2018, the Supreme Court addressed ultimately a question of what to do when there's a silent affirmance by a state high court of a lower court's decision. And the court held that in those circumstances, you have to look through to assess the reasoning of the lower court because there's a presumption that the state Supreme Court relied on that same decision making. This is not a look through case. So to be clear, the look through holding of Wilson does not apply in this case. But it only mattered in Wilson. It was only necessary to look through because, as the Supreme Court held in Wilson, it is necessary to figure out what the state court...
Can I just cut to the chase here? Is your position contrary to the Shepard case from the Fifth Circuit, the footnote that's on this issue?
So the Fifth Circuit, as I read, Shepard didn't fully resolve this, although they did. I agree, they seemed skeptical of this.
We review the decision. We don't review... I mean, it's pretty broad, right? We just review how it came out and then we figure out the details. I mean, that's how I understand that opinion to be worded. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's right. And certainly that was a common pre-Wilson approach. And I agree that the courts of appeals are still figuring out how to square that with Wilson. And, you know, with all respect to the Fifth Circuit, I think that approach simply cannot be squared with Wilson because it can't be squared with Wilson's holding.
Does that apply? Okay. So, and then we have a case on that. I can't remember the name of it. Shepard, what is it? Holland versus Rivard, is that it?
Yes, that's it.
So we've said pretty clearly what that footnote says in the Fifth Circuit. We've said it. So the argument is that Wilson, sub silentio overturns Holland in all those kinds of cases?
I wouldn't agree that it's sub silentio. I mean, it didn't cite Holland. The Supreme Court doesn't always cite every lower court case that is affected by its reasoning. But yes, I mean, the Supreme Court said as clear as could be that the court must focus on the particular reasons, both factual and legal, given by the state court and review those reasons. And the only way to do that is to focus on those reasons and not just on the ultimate outcome. So that doesn't...
I understand your reading of the language in Wilson, but I mean, that wasn't the issue, as you've acknowledged in Wilson. It was a question about look through and no reasoning at all by the last court. I mean, it would be a pretty big thing for us to say, oh, and by the way, it also overruled all of these other cases that talked about a decision as opposed to the specific facts or the specific reasoning relied on. I mean, don't you think that's a pretty big ask?
Well, Your Honor, I think it is simply a necessary consequence of what Wilson held, because if it is just the ultimate decision that matters, then the look-through question doesn't matter, because all that would matter is what was the holding, what was the outcome, and then you just defer to that outcome. And so there would be no need to figure out whether you look through to a lower court's reasoning or you hypothesize other reasoning, because the reasoning wouldn't matter. The way Your Honor describes it, the way Holland describes it, the only thing that matters is the outcome. And if that's right, then look-through is beside the point. And Wilson holds very clearly that look-through is not beside the point. It's required. And the necessary consequence of that is the court has to, in applying AEDPA deference, look at the actual reasons and defer to those actual reasons. Now, that doesn't mean that the court has to grant a writ of habeas corpus if the court thinks there are other good, sufficient reasons to justify the conviction. It doesn't. What we're talking about here is just the scope of AEDPA deference. In this case, and in many cases, there are other forms of deference also applicable here. Jackson has its own form of deference. And in any event, if the court thinks that de novo, there was no violation of a federal right, then there's never any need to grant a writ of habeas corpus.
Would we need to remand to the district court if we agreed to you, or could we just apply the proper analysis ourselves and proper deference to the exact holding of the Michigan Court of Appeals decision?
I think the court's ordinary practice where the wrong standard was applied would be to remand, but I agree that it's not required. If the court wants to, the court can proceed on its own to review the matter de novo. If the court does so, though, this issue is still very important because it affects the court's own review and the level of deference that this court must apply as well. So it would mean that if this court looks at evidence beyond the particular evidence considered by the state court, then there's only one level of deference. So it's just the Jackson deference. And in that case, the court's federal decisions are equally controlling because those decisions are all decided under a Jackson standard.
If we wanted to consider the informant's testimony ourselves and the bullet or whatever else we wanted to add in beyond what the Michigan Court of Appeals considered, we would just be applying Jackson ourselves. It would be de novo review of the Michigan Court of Appeals, but it would be essentially applying Jackson ourselves without the AEDPA gloss on it.
Yes, absolutely. And therefore, it would be exactly the same sort of review that the court does in federal direct appeals of federal convictions, because the court applies the Jackson standard directly in those cases as well. And so I don't want to be heard to argue that that's not an option for the court. The court can do that if it wants. If it does, then I think cases like Bailey become extremely significant, because if the court looks at Bailey, that's a direct federal appeal. It's under a constructive possession standard that this court already held in Parker is an identical standard to the Michigan standard. And in Bailey, there was a gun. In Bailey, unlike here, the defendant was alone in the car. In Bailey, unlike here, the gun was under the defendant's own seat, not under a different seat. In Bailey, like this case, it was a drug case. So whatever the significance of there being a drug dealing element may be, Bailey was a possession with intent to distribute case as well. And so if this court is applying Jackson deference, then Bailey, I think, is controlling, and Bailey would require that the conviction cannot stand. And by the way, even if AEDPA deference is applied, which I don't believe it should be, except to the precise reasons of the Michigan Court of Appeals, Parker is also a controlling case. Parker was a case under AEDPA, under these exact same Michigan statutes, and Parker was a case with much stronger evidence than is present here. In Parker, there were two guns in plain view in the back seat. The defendant was in the back seat. That already is much, much more than there is in this case. Plus, in Parker, there was flight. There was no flight here. And yes, the court in Parker found the flight not very persuasive, but still, that was an element that was not present in this case at all. In fact, in this case, the testimony is very clear from the police officers that Mr. Thompson made no furtive movements, no efforts to hide anything, no efforts to flee. He was cooperative throughout. The fact is that in this case, there just is nothing. And where the court has found sufficient evidence, there's always been quite a lot more, whether that's testimony from a witness that the defendant was seen with the gun, which is very much absent here, whether that's the fact that the gun was practically touching the defendant, which is much more than is present here.
Have, um, we, ever, Have we ever talked about guns as tools of the drug trade in a direct federal appeal as adding to proximity to give indicia of control?
Not in any case that I have been able to find. I think the closest case
Why doesn't that distinguish Michigan the way the Michigan courts have interpreted their own possession law?
So I think they're in two ways. So first of all, to be clear, the Michigan court's interpretation of their own possession law is controlling as to the elements of the offense, but it's undisputed what the elements of the offense are. They have to prove constructive possession. The state law is not controlling as to what level of evidence is necessary to prove that. Jackson is very clear that that is a separate federal due process requirement.
If the Michigan courts say that for purposes of our criminal law, guns are tools of the trade and proximity, i.e. in the passenger cabin of a car in a drug case, is enough to convict you beyond a reasonable doubt of this crime under Michigan law. Why is that not give us the elements of the crime in Michigan?
So that cannot be enough, or else Jackson just disappears, because it will always be true in a Jackson habeas case that the state courts thought the evidence was sufficient. And so if the state court's finding that the evidence was sufficient simply means that the state court elements are met, then there will never be a Jackson habeas case. Jackson's majority opinion addressed that and distinguished specifically between the federal standard on what is sufficient evidence and the state question of what are the elements. Now, if Michigan wanted to say that it's unlawful for a person who is selling drugs to be near a gun without any possession requirement, I guess there would be a question about whether constitutionally Michigan can criminalize that. But that's not what Michigan has done. The court has already held in Parker that what Michigan has done is require proof of constructive possession, which is the same as the federal standard, and that's also what the Michigan courts say. And second of all, it's not clear that the Michigan courts have adopted this sort of strict liability for drug dealers rule, even if that were something that could be controlling. There are two cases that do this. One is LaFountain, which I think is very clearly distinguishable in that the guns were in plain view, and the court seems to already conclude that there was constructive possession before turning to the question of whether it was related to the drug evidence. And then the other case is Rapley, which is a one paragraph affirmance. If the court looks at the Court of Appeals decision in Rapley, the defendant was sitting basically on top of the gun. The defendant was found sitting on a mattress. The gun was within his reach underneath the mattress. This court has recognized from time to time that there's proximity and there's proximity. And here, this is much less proximity than in Rapley.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fox. Mr. Palaz.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Palace, Assistant Attorney General from the state of Michigan. I represent the respondent appellee in this case, Gregory Skipper. Hello to brother counsel, Mr. Fox, as well. I'm going to start right off with the proverbial elephant in the room, that is the Supreme Court's 2018 decision in Wilson versus Seller. Brother counsel advocated his position very articulately and very forcefully, but it's our position that Wilson has little, if likely no, impact on this case. And why is that? Because Wilson's a case about the Yost look-through principle. The Supreme Court in that case did not otherwise find error with the 11th Circuit's application of Harrington versus Richter, nor did it limit or otherwise pull back on Richter's what I would call game-changing holding. Rather, it found error with the 11th Circuit treating the Georgia Supreme Court's unexplained summary denials of relief as a blank slate upon which the circuit court could project any reasonable reason for denying relief. This was in fact because there was a reasoned decision just below the Supreme Court in the Georgia Court of Appeals. And the Supreme Court in Wilson said that what the federal court should have done there is look through the unexplained order to the last state court decision that provided a rationale for the denial of relief, there being the Georgia Court of Appeals opinion, and then presume that the higher unexplained decision adopts the same reasoning. It said also it should not have speculated about the reasons that the Georgia Supreme Court could have denied the claim in this very specific scenario. That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
But isn't your friend on the other side exactly correct that Holland, a broad reading of Holland, is inconsistent with Wilson, isn't it? I mean, the look-through doesn't, the whole look-through thing doesn't make sense if we can just review the decision. Don't we, there's something about the rationale, the reasoning, the facts that they have to, we have to look at exactly what the state court did at some level, right?
Well, that's true. And I think what has happened here and what Wilson did was there was some, what I would call dicta at the beginning when they're quoting Justice Ginsburg's concurrence in a denial of a cert petition, and then kind of move on to what I believe is actually the holding of the case. And frankly, I think when you look at what some of, and Brother Counsel is completely right, the circuits are struggling with this. The Fifth Circuit seems to have gone the same position that we are. The Seventh Circuit seems to have gone the position of the of Mr. Fox. And then the 11th Circuit appears to still be finding in the same way that I would in this case. I think the look-through provision is just sort of an extension, the Yost provision of already existing law. And I really do believe that if the court, the Supreme Court in Wilson meant to so radically pivot away from the language from pivot or limit the language in Richter about how you look at reasons that could have supported the state court's decision, it would have done so much more explicitly, in my opinion. I don't think that Wilson either says that in the appropriate circumstances, the habeas court can't come up with alternative rationales that could have supported the decision. If even if you consider Justice Ginsburg's language as part of the holding of the case, it just says train its attention to the reasons and the facts cited by the state court. It doesn't rule out the approach that Richter and so many other cases, including Holland and this circuit, have taken to say that the could have approach or could have reasoned approach is the way to go in reviewing cases in federal habeas. Now, Brother Counsel cites some language from Wilson that without context may make it seem as though Wilson's command is to quote unquote focus exclusively on quote the actual reasons given by the lower court, state court, but that's not a holding. That's really more an observation about what the court did in the Primo versus Moore case. And think about this. And I think Judge Nalbandian, there was one of your questions kind of went towards this. If Thompson is correct in his interpretation of Wilson, it could lead to anomalous results of federal courts granting habeas relief when there has in fact been no constitutional violation. I mean, what would happen there is just merely because the state court didn't cite or articulate particular reasons for its decision, even though those reasons would be valid, that would render the decision unreasonable under that interpretation of Wilson. So you're having a finding of unconstitutionality when there really isn't unconstitutionality.
Wouldn't you just lose epidefference in that case? And then all you would get is, I mean, like in this case, you'd still get Jackson versus Virginia. It's a pretty high standard for them to meet. I mean,
it is a high standard.
But I mean, you don't get the added deference. So it's de novo, I guess, but you still get, I mean, look, it's a federal court still kind of revisiting what a state court did, which, you know, has federalism implications, of course, but still, you know, you would get whatever the appellate review standard is, right? I mean, we would just be reviewing under Jackson.
I agree, Your Honor. I mean, my only point is that to get there and to kind of strip the decision of its AEDPA deference would mean basically finding that it's unreasonable. And I don't know how you find a decision. And again, that's the language that's used even in 2254 itself, is talking about an unreasonable decision, not an unreasonable opinion or unreasonable reasoning. It talks about decision. So I just think that it unnecessarily, and maybe I didn't articulate it quite correctly, but I do agree with Brother Counsel to that extent, that if this court were to find that Wilson controls here and that the otherwise AEDPA shouldn't apply in this case, there would still be a level of deference to the jury's verdict itself, while not necessarily to the Court of Appeals, Michigan Court of Appeals opinion, there'd be deference to the jury's verdict under Jackson.
So if there's no AEDPA deference here, how do you distinguish Bailey from this case?
Well, I think these cases have to be looked at really, especially when, and I'll be the first to admit, this isn't the strongest case of weapon possession that I've ever seen. But I think at the same time, you have to look at what the, let's say you strip the decision of AEDPA deference. And so therefore, in my opinion, it's no longer tied to what the Michigan Court of Appeals said. So you could bring in some other facts, including the Michigan Court of Appeals, the district court's finding concerning the defendant, the prisoner being observed on another occasion with a gun in that very same vehicle when Mr. Schumacher wasn't even in the vehicle. And this, the fact that there was a bullet found in on his person on that night of the arrest. Now, granted, it probably wasn't the same bullet, a bullet that would have fit that particular gun, but it does also link him to firearms, drugs, firearms, bullet. It all kind of meshes together to, I think, distinguish Bailey in a way that would distinguish it sufficiently so that even on de novo review, this court should be able to affirm the district court's decision in this case. And I think the going back to sort of Wilson and how it is really would be a sea change if that interpretation of Wilson goes becomes sort of the law of the land. There's cases, for example, there's a pre-Richter decision, Early versus Packer, that said AEDPA's not violated so long as neither the reasoning nor the result of the decision is unreasonable. There's a post-Richter decision by the Supreme Court in Broomfield versus Kane, which is cited in our brief, which talks about a habeas court looking at the record to find facts that might lead it to conclude that the state court decision was reasonable. And then, of course, there's the Holland versus Rivard case, which the court mentions, where specifically in that case, there was deference applied to the state court's decision that the Miranda Edwards protections didn't apply, but not the particular reason. But it's just simply the decision denying relief there. And then as well as the Smith versus Cook case, which I believe was also mentioned earlier today. And again, looking at the plain language of AEDPA, it supports the holdings pre-Wilson and supports the view that what the Supreme Court did in Wilson was simply talk about the Yost look-through presumption. It did not look at changing Richter or limiting Richter in any word, in any way. The choice of the words decision in 2254 itself is very significant. Now, whether or not the petitioner's interpretation of Wilson versus Sellers prevails here in this court, whether he's correct about what Wilson says is kind of besides the point, because even if, in our opinion, even if Wilson requires a habeas court to look only at the stated reasons or facts for determining reasonableness, the state court's analysis in support of its decision finding sufficient evidence to support the firearms offenses is the convictions of the firearms offenses is ultimately reasonable. And one thing I kind of want to point out in looking at the Michigan Court of Appeals opinion, it's interesting how its discussion after it talks about there's some boilerplate in there. And then it says, quote, upon review of the trial court record or the trial record, we find there was sufficient evidence for a rational trier of fact to find that defendant had constructive possession of the firearm found in his vehicle. And then the court does go, as Mr. Fox has indicated, to list essentially two points about the sufficiency of that evidence or those particular examples. Ironically, if the court had just stopped with that sentence, we wouldn't even be here talking about whether AEDPA deference applied or not. And because this court went a step further and listed some examples of why it thought the trial record supported the conviction, that's where this issue suddenly arose. Which I think is another problem with the interpretation of Wilson that's being advocated here, in which some of the circuits seem to be heading in that same direction. But even limited to just the evidence that the Michigan Court of Appeals cited, we would assert that that's not an unreasonable application of Jackson. There's certainly the proximity of the weapon. Thompson is driving the vehicle on all the occasions which he is encountered with it. Now, granted, it wasn't registered to him.
Do you think that Michigan law is different in some sense than the federal law? Could it be, and is it? In other words, like proximity, closer proximity, is you know, the court talks about the proximity in this case, and it was under the, you know, not under his seat. It was under the seat in the back. But in effect, but in Bailey or in some federal cases, even if it's under your own seat, that's not enough. I mean, is it just a different, is it a different standard? Different because it's a different law? What's going on with the proximity, for example?
Well, I think you may be correct, Judge. I think there may be some slight differences in the federal and state standards, but certainly under AEDPA, assuming that AEDPA survives, and we talk about limiting it, the decision to the, or limiting review to what the state court said. I mean, I would think that that would encompass looking at the state law on the subject, because the other thing that I'm not so sure is real prevalent in federal law is this quote unquote well-known relationship between drug dealing and the use of firearms as protection, which as Brother Counsel indicated is in the LaFountain case, as well as the People versus Rapley order from the Michigan Supreme Court. And one thing I just want to say in respect to that second point is there was no question but that Thompson was a drug dealer. We're not talking about the sufficiency of the evidence to support those convictions. The informant purchased drugs from Thompson on two separate occasions, and the buy money from at least one of those buys is with Thompson, not with Shoemaker, when he is arrested. Moreover, the informant only dealt with Thompson when purchasing the drugs she purchased with the buy money, even though the buys themselves were occurring in an apartment which apparently belonged to Schumacher. And there was a significant amount of drugs ultimately found in this vehicle, not just heroin, but up in the sunroof area of the vehicle, there was 17 packets of cocaine hidden in or around that sunroof apparatus. And then the gun was underneath the passenger seat behind Thompson. So, you know, and again, just to wrap up really quickly, there are facts that, you know, assuming that we can look at them, other facts, the fact that the informant saw a gun, maybe not the same gun, but saw a gun in the vehicle, that same vehicle, when another occasion within that same week that Mr. Thompson was driving the vehicle around, that gun was actually in plain view, unlike the one in this situation. Just as sort of a side point, that's the third time in about a period of week that Mr. Thompson's been driving the same vehicle. And an important point about that is that there were different individuals in the vehicle that time than there were when he was stopped with Mr. Schumacher. So that, to me, you can infer from that possibly, you know, since there were guns in this vehicle on both occasions, that the common denominator of all of that is Mr. Thompson. And the same goes for the bullet in the pocket, as I described earlier. I see I'm just about out of time, so unless your honors have any questions, which I'd be happy to answer, I'm just going to rest on our brief. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Pallas. Mr. Fox.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think four points. First, I'll start with the prior trip in the SUV about a week earlier. I think at one point, Mr. Pallas said that Mr. Thompson was seen with a gun on that trip. I just want to be clear that is not what the record shows. The record shows that the gun was in the back, the very rear of the vehicle. There were four people in the vehicle on that day. No evidence that Mr. Thompson saw the gun, and certainly no evidence that Mr. Thompson had the gun. Second, there was a reference to it maybe having been a different gun. The record is it was definitely a different gun. The informant was very clear that it was not the same gun. And there were four other people in the car. So there's no, oh, and finally, the police, Mr. Pallas said it was in plain view, and I guess it was in plain view to the informant, but the record also showed that the police pulled over Mr. Thompson on that day, looked in the car with flashlights, and did not see the gun. So it's not at all.
Was the owner of the car the other occupant?
There's nothing in the record, and I don't know who was the owner of the car. All that's in the record is that Mr. Thompson was not the owner of the car. So, you know, the prior trip just really neither links Mr. Thompson to guns in general, except that he was in a car, apparently with a gun, no evidence he knew it, nor certainly links him to this particular gun, given that it was a different gun. Also on the bullet, I mean, the bullet just does nothing to link Mr. Thompson to this particular gun. For better or worse, as I understand it, it's not unlawful in Michigan for Mr. Thompson to possess ammunition. Perhaps it could be, but it's not. The testimony was that the bullet did not fit the gun. So it just does nothing to close the gap. That's the key gap between Mr. Thompson and this gun.
It wasn't completely clear, right? The police officer speculated that it probably wouldn't, but it was, I mean, it was like a 9mm and it was, and there's a 30, I mean, it, and the gun was a 38 or vice versa, whatever it is, probably wouldn't fit, but sometimes it might fit. Right. So
I don't know
that it was completely clear, was it?
Well, I think the difficulty is it's true that the officer in the only testimony on the question said he wasn't sure, but probably it wouldn't fit. The problem is that's the only testimony. There's no testimony in the record from which the jury could conclude that it probably would fit. We're dealing with proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So the fact that maybe they didn't believe him, or they thought, even though the officer thought it probably wouldn't fit, the jury thought maybe it would fit, that's not going to close a beyond a reasonable doubt evidentiary gap when there's no evidence suggesting it would fit. You know, I did some internet research of my own, and I guess sometimes they fit and sometimes they don't, but none of that research is in the record. And so there's just no basis for the jury to infer that the gun and the bullet went together.
The bullet does show that he tends to show he's a gun owner or a gun user, doesn't it?
I would say not necessarily, in that someone can buy a bullet without owning a gun, but that kind of general tie to guns is not enough. You know, the law is clear. They need to show that he possessed this gun, the gun charged in the indictment. And that bullet just isn't going to show that. There are many reasons why someone might have a bullet. There's nothing in the record about why Mr. Thompson had a bullet, except that it doesn't fit this gun. And so, you know, when we're dealing with proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and the bullet, I think, just isn't going to make a significant difference. Certainly it's less than what the evidence was in Bailey, where you had gun under the driver's seat, you had exclusive possession of the car, you had furtive movements, you had attempts to evade arrest. That is much, much more than just sort of a bullet that doesn't fit the gun, which is what we have here. On Wilson briefly, I think the point that you just can't square Wilson's holding, it really is a holding, with the holding on look through with the idea that you just look at the decision is exactly right. I'd also point the court to language in the second paragraph of Wilson that describes, I mean, this is, I guess, dicta, but it describes very clearly in very plain terms what the inquiry should be when the last state court to decide a prisoner's federal claim explains its decision on the merits, which is what we have here, and what it is in that case. A federal habeas court simply reviews the specific reasons given by the state court and defers to those reasons if they are reasonable. And so that's direct language from the Supreme Court on what to do in this kind of case that's not a look-through case. That requires the court to focus on the specific reasons. And just, you know, a paragraph earlier, the court had said specific reasons, both legal and factual. And so it's not just a matter of what is the legal reasoning. Otherwise, the Supreme Court would not have said and factual.
Let me ask you, under Michigan law, is it possible for both the driver and the occupant to be in constructive possession of a gun in a vehicle?
Yes, but you would need evidence that each of them was in constructive possession of the gun. In other words, you can't just say, well, since it's in the car and they're both in the car, we're just going to say it's both of theirs. You would need to meet the test under cases like Parker and cases like Wolf, that as to each of them, showing the connection between them and the gun. And again, the mere proximity is just not enough. It's not enough for Mr. Thompson. It wouldn't be enough for Mr. Schumacher.
So I take it for actual possession, only one person can be actually in possession of a gun, but it's possible for more than one person to be in constructive possession of a gun.
That's correct. But again, you have to meet the constructive possession standard as to each of them. And finally, very quickly, there's no evidence that either Michigan or the federal law thinks that there's a difference in the standards. Wolf says that the standard is the federal standard, and this court in Parker said the same thing. Unless there are further questions, I will ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you to both sides. I believe you're both CJA appointed. The argument today was excellent. We will take the case under submission.